SCP-001, The Stillborn City, Part 1. Much has been said and discussed over the years about what to do if you find yourself in a survival situation. Things like finding a water and food source, and setting up shelter, or how to find help. These things are all well and good, even if most people never have to utilize this knowledge in any form, but I can't really imagine how much a Foundation field agent would have to know to survive during their jobs. New, hellish dimensions seem to crop up every day, and of course, unfortunate agents are tossed headfirst into them with the slimmest chances of survival. This SCP-001 proposal looks at one such agent that finds herself in a particularly nightmarish situation of the Sarkic variety, and her efforts to try to get back out of it. Let's take a look. SCP-001 is presently hypothesized to be either an alternate iteration of Earth, or an amalgamation of many such iterations, or an extra-dimensional manifestation that includes some superficial similarities to Earth. It was only discovered when data was recovered from an ocular implant that was formerly attached to the right eye socket of Agent Margot Kennedy. The current status of Agent Kennedy remains unknown. She is a member of MTF Psi-13, Witch Hunters, a highly classified joint Foundation Global Occult Coalition task force created as part of Project Citra Akra. Citra Akra is from SCP-2480, an unfinished ritual, in which a group of Neo-Sarkics opened a portal in a town in Massachusetts, allowing invisible Sarkic entities to pour through. Citra Akra was the project set up to combat these entities and keep them out of our reality, although it seemed like other such portals were likely opening up elsewhere. MTF Psi-13 is designed for the infiltration of Neo-Sarkic organizations and the termination of high-threat members. That leads us to Operation Black Citadel, focused on person of interest Vivian Durant Croy. Croy was born to an unidentified mother and Cyril Durant, patriarch of House Durant, a family whose history and bloodline is intertwined with Sarkicism. In 1996, she married a Hungarian national, the CEO of Abraxas Arms, and suspected Neo-Sarkite. She is now the president and CEO of the Durant Bodefell Financial Group, and a rising figure in Neo-Sarkicism. Agents involved in Citra Akra have uncovered that she is slated to become the acting Karsist, or spiritual leader, of the Order of the Crimson Star, a Neo-Sarkic chapter primarily active in the Middle Atlantic region of the US. The objective of Operation Black Citadel, then, is to infiltrate the Order of the Crimson Star and terminate Croy, with three agents involved: Margot Kennedy, Daniel Kane, and Patrick Taylor. They managed to successfully infiltrate the Order and were invited to a special ceremony on January 12, 2014, at Croy Manor, in which Croy would experience her metaphorical and possibly literal metamorphosis into a Karsist. Once cleared to do so, the agents will terminate Croy, with operatives from a second MTF on standby in case of escalation. Croy Manor is believed to be the group's primary headquarters, a mansion located in a secluded and heavily forested section of New York State. The three agents all have various cybernetic augmentations, including an ocular implant that allows for live streaming video footage back to command, a cranial augmentation that allows for audio recording, and subdermal biotelemetric monitors for the tracking of vital signs. The three arrive at Croy Manor disguised as members, wearing upper-class attire and masquerade masks. They're asked through the intercom at the front gate what hour it is, to which they reply that it is the 11th hour, and soon the Crimson Star will rise. They're let into the manor grounds, lit by decorative red glass lanterns hung from trees. A doorman dressed like a Victorian-era valet with a black hood opens the front door of the manor for them, and they enter to see an interior composed of polished black stone and red glass lanterns, similar to those hanging from the trees, with chamber music audible throughout. Paintings, tapestries, and statues decorate the atrium, including a 5-meter-tall marble sculpture in the center depicting an entity with a lion head and a worm-like body, believed to be a representation of Yaldabaoth, a malevolent creator deity that isn't worshipped by most Sarkic cults. There are around a couple hundred individuals in the atrium, all wearing masks, with most of them appearing to be mid-coitus while others lounge, converse, and observe. What light is present is starkly red, causing most individuals to appear as silhouettes against a red background. The three agents take a corner table, seeing servants wander the room offering wine and hors d'oeuvres. Agent Kennedy quips that if the other two agents want to join in, she won't judge, but she's keeping her pants on. Agent Taylor chuckles, but Kane just scans the room and tells them to keep their game faces on, and to holler if they see the person of interest. Some time passes, and the orgy continues, although certain groups of participants are performing more and more extreme actions against each other. One woman slowly flays the skin off of a man's back as several individuals watch and offer advice, while other men are being held down and kicked by a group. Surrounding the outside of the atrium are abnormally tall, stationary individuals wearing hooded robes, appearing to serve as security as they silently maintain watch over the manor's interior. While circling the atrium, Agent Taylor accidentally brushes against a statue, causing it to fall and be caught by one of these individuals with a grotesque, misshapen hand ending in claws like gnarled bones. The entity's only vocalization is a growl. Command orders Kane to continue the search for Croy, while Kennedy and Taylor remain at the atrium, where they begin to kiss in an effort to blend in. Kane slips out of the atrium and deeper into the manor to a series of chambers that encircle the atrium and contain smaller rooms for meetings. He overhears one conversation about some blood that is diluted and weak, but another individual says that even the smallest drop of the true blood sets them apart from the swine. Any remnant of the Sisterhood's genes is full of potential. He also overhears a heated discussion between two men discussing Ayun's paradise. One man calls it a pipe dream, saying that Ayun failed to reach apotheosis, and such failure should be interpreted as a warning. True paradise is available to those with the power to seize it, and Ayun threw away his potential for godhood for altruism. The difference between them and the proto-Sarkics is that the neo-Sarkics seek power and are unafraid to use it. Ayun consumed the death of gods, and they consume Ayun, or at least his dream. Carnomancy serving the many has a limit, but when it serves the individual is when the real power can be felt. The other man says that he has seen things in those backwater villages that would turn his stomach, insane things he couldn't begin to replicate. The one man says that they have traditions, not power, as power comes from ambition. The Neo-Sarkics are the true disciples, and he can revere Ayun all he wants, but if he wants real power, he should try supping at the bowl he did. The other man asks if he means Yaldabaoth, but the man cuts him off, telling him that they never know who could be listening. Kane also overhears a man and a woman speaking with a hunched, cloaked figure with pale tendrils dangling from its cowl, identified as Karsist Tuslar. The Karsist speech is incomprehensible, but the man asks if they are here to enact the rites, as he doubts that they've come all this way just to speak with those so far beneath them. The woman thanks the Karsist for their words of wisdom and says that she looks forward to them and Karsist Sakaral opening the way. Kane then encounters an entity with the appearance of a quadruple amputee woman equipped with unusually long blade-like prosthesis. Closer analysis of this footage suggests that the appendages are actually part of her anatomy, and likely the result of Sarkic flesh crafting. The subject balances on her pointed limbs with her hips raised off the ground and chest facing upwards, completely nude except for a black blindfold. Her skin is marked with intricate but unrecognizable sigil tattoos, as well as piercings, and she approaches Kane while crawling backwards on all four limbs. Command reminds Kane to remain in character, and he complies, allowing her to do something that's been removed from the record. Kane completes his interaction with the woman after an interval of approximately 36 minutes, and Command orders him to continue his search for Croy, although he's interrupted by the ringing of a gong-like instrument. Guests immediately abandon their activities and proceed down a hallway located at the atrium's northeast, so Command orders all three agents to follow the crowd. The video feed shows a grand dining room containing many circular tables as well as a long table reserved for the more prestigious guests. The agents seat themselves and are joined by 12 other guests, as servants enter and serve a full course dinner. The main course resembles beef and is served with chateau potatoes, and Kennedy remarks that it doesn't taste like steak, more like pork, before realizing what it is. Command tells her to remain in character, and she consumes the rest of the meal quickly, struggling towards the end, while Taylor refuses to eat, merely sipping at the champagne. Throughout the course of the meal, the agents engaged in conversation with the other guests, revealing a few tidbits of information. All of the guests at the table were born to or married into families whose accumulated wealth and power dates back centuries. At least two of them are politicians at the US federal level. At least one owns an arms manufacturer that is regularly considered the third largest in North America. At least three are involved in the financial sector, including stewarding several significant hedge funds. And at least one is a partner in a major law firm, dealing with international trade and negotiations between nation states. The others appear to be socialites, their source of wealth unknown. At least one conversation noted the participants' enjoyment of illegal underground fighting rooms, often leading to grave injuries or death. Neo-Sarkites, at least among the Black Blood upper class, appear to be prone to schemes and conspiracy, with it being rumored that Croy achieved her position following the assassination of a rival, a common tactic among Neo-Sarkites. The gathering also includes guests from other Neo-Sarkic cults, such as Adatum's Wake, the Hunter's Black Lodge, the Esoteric Order of the White Worm, and the Leviathan Society. The gong-like instrument then sounds again, causing the guests to return to the atrium, where the lion-headed statue is no longer present. Instead, a hidden spiral staircase is revealed, and the agents follow the other guests as they descend down, the steps appearing to glisten as if damp. A red organic substance coats the stone like a slime mold. The staircase connects to a subterranean structure which more closely resembles a temple rather than a cellar, and they continue through a hallway which leads into a spherical chamber containing an empty basin made of bones and skulls. The chamber is designed much like an amphitheater, allowing the guests to comfortably occupy it in staggered stages of platforms. Approximately 15 bound and gagged women, men, and children hang upside down above the basin, which itself contains a large, pulsating object resembling a chrysalis. Karsist Tuslar then ascends a raised edifice overlooking the basin and begins to chant unintelligibly as hooded servants enter the basin armed with ornate scythes, using them to tear the gags from their captives, often mutilating their faces in the process. The captives begin to scream and plead with their captors, none of whom respond, and the servants use their scythes to saw through the captives. Based on video analysis, several of the victims were identified as known missing persons, but the majority remain unidentified. The chrysalis is bathed in blood and organs as the sacrifice reaches completion. The cultists then begin to vocalize without speaking any discernible words, creating a melody similar to those produced by throat singing, and the chrysalis suddenly ruptures, appearing to be torn apart from the inside. An entity rises from the mangled husk as the chanting grows louder and the video feed begins to violently distort. Tuslar raises a sacrificial bowl filled with burning oil, and an unidentified speaker announces that the soul has become flesh, and for Karsist Sakaral to arise. Based on the appearance of its humanoid head and torso, the entity is quickly identified as Croy, who has undergone significant metamorphosis. She now stands on three legs, appearing to be approximately 2.7 meters tall, and much of her body is composed of white and black chitin. She now has six wings with black and gold markings, two raptorial arms, a pale humanoid upper body, and long blonde hair. Command orders the agents to terminate the persons of interest, and all three draw out their weapons. Three bursts from their sidearms strike Tuslar in the back, spraying blood across Croy's face and torso. As Tuslar falls to the ground, the bowl is upturned, splashing several nearby hostiles in burning oil, along with Croy's hair. She screams and raises two upper extremities, ending in sharp claws, resembling those of a crab. Two robed hostiles carrying scythes pounce on Kane, their scythes slicing through his midsection entirely, spilling blood and entrails onto the ground. Kennedy and Taylor retreat to the atrium, firing on the two hostiles as well as Croy, who is pursuing. Kennedy covers Taylor with suppressive fire as he places remote-controlled explosive devices throughout the stairwell. The two then continue to retreat before detonating the explosives, which collapse much of the atrium's floor, creating a large fissure and spreading fire to the ceiling and surrounding walls. The structure of the manor begins to shake in the resulting explosions, with marble and plaster debris raining down on the two agents. Four robed humanoids charge at the agents, running on all four limbs, and Taylor fires his pistol at one of them, drawing the attention of the pack. They shed their robes as they approach, revealing pale, naked flesh and faces dominated by toothy, vertical mouths. The four pounce on Taylor, and blood sprays across the ground and into Kennedy's face. She is momentarily blinded and calls out to Taylor, but as she cleans the blood from her eyes, she sees the four entities grinding their mouths on Taylor's eviscerated corpse. She empties her magazine into the four, killing two and wounding the others as they run screeching into the burning hall across the atrium floor. MTF Psi-9 is then ordered to storm Croy Manor to neutralize the hostiles and secure the scene. Kennedy sees that the spreading fire prevents access to all prospective escape routes, and the floor collapses beneath the two fleeing entities. The remains of Taylor and the deceased entities fall into the widening chasm, as purple smoke and flames rise from the opening. Croy is observed rising from the rubble of the staircase where Taylor set the explosives, climbing vertically up the walls. Her skin is rippling underneath the carapace, exuding more layers of chitinous material to seal the wounds sustained in the falling rubble. Kennedy shouts and fires several shots at Croy, wounding her shoulder and causing her to momentarily shudder. The video feed distorts as the walls begin to crack and exude organic material resembling blood, and the apertures in the wall form gaping organic wounds. Kennedy continues firing, and a bullet strikes Croy in the forehead, rocking her head back as blood flows over her from the sphincters opening up in the walls of the collapsing atrium. Kennedy swears at Croy as black tendrils erupt from the lower level, coiling themselves around parts of the manor's architecture and tearing it to completely obliterate the building. Kennedy falls as the floor crumbles beneath her feet, and the video feed goes black. The tendrils disappeared before the arrival of MTF Psi-9, along with Croy Manor itself, leaving only a crater behind and no remains. Given the state of the site and the apparent destruction, all agents were declared deceased shortly after Foundation forces appeared on the scene. Approximately 8 hours after her disappearance, however, the Foundation began to receive the GPS coordinates of Agent Kennedy, although radio contact could not be reestablished. Kennedy's signal was traced to an alleyway in a district in Hong Kong, over 12,000 kilometers from where she had initially gone missing. Only her augmented right eye was ever recovered. We're given a notice from the Records and Information Security Administration telling us that the video and audio data transcribed in the rest of this file constitutes a Class A ontological perspective shift. Individuals who review the materials will experience the events from a perspective other than their own, although the process by which the transcript derived from the augmentation was manipulated is poorly understood. The video file frequently suffers unexplained distortions throughout its entire 1,224-hour length, although these distortions are only visible for fractions of a second, manifesting as symbols of unknown meaning. Over 80,000 symbols have been detected by video analysis software, with each instance being unique, non-repeating, and cognitohazardous to observers. The remainder of the article details Kennedy's experiences while missing, written from the second perspective as part of this ontological shift when a viewer re-experiences it through the augmentation. I'll try to read these sections verbatim as much as possible to maintain that effect, although I will note that there is some harsh language used throughout. You regain consciousness slowly, blinking at the dim red light surrounding you. The air is full of dust. Red light seeps from the walls with no obvious source. The red intrudes into your forebrain like a glowing hot poker pulled directly from a fire. The augmentation in your eye scales down into low light mode, bringing your surroundings into starker relief. The walls are rough granite, maybe. The ceiling, which is low and also rough-hewn stone, is barely illuminated by the red light pouring from alcoves along the passageway you find yourself in. You cough. It's hard to breathe in here. The air is stale and chalky. The temperature is cool. You're almost certainly underground. You sit up, pushing yourself up by your elbows. The tunnel trails off into the distance until it curves out of sight. There is no one near you. No Karsist mutated into a spider-like centaur creature. No fellow agents. Nor their remains. You have no idea how long you've been unconscious. Command? You ask out loud, causing a frantic coughing fit. Command, do you read me? Silence is your only response. You prop yourself up against the wall, try to understand what has happened. The last thing you remember... God damn it. Kane ripped apart by those sarcic monstrosities. Taylor taken out the same way. Fuck, his blood is still all over you. Mixed with the grit of stone dust in the air. Kane was a pain in the ass, but Taylor was all right. He had a good sense of humor. Now he's spread out like a stain on that marble floor. If the manor is still standing, that is. Wait, how did you get here? Everything hurts. Your lungs are filled with rock dust. Your arms and legs. Your head from whatever fall you took through the floor of the manor. Your ego. What was that fucking plan? Infiltrate a cult gathering and put a hit on a monster. You'll have backup, they said. Sure. Where? The next country over? You thought when you came in from the military that the Foundation would be different. But there's even less respect for the grunt here. Kane and Taylor died to accomplish the mission. You're just sure there were better ways to get this mission done. You look around at your surroundings. The darkly colored stone walls are covered in a creeping organic material, rising along the walls from the floor. The material seems like kudzu, but made of scabs and flesh and teeth. You stand, finally, dusting yourself off and checking for injury. Other than soreness, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with you. You've even still got your pistol, a semi-automatic with a dozen rounds left. You reach out and touch the kudzu, feeling the rough surface with slight give. It's hard and yet spongy with a moist texture. A wave of revulsion travels down from the base of your skull to your stomach, leaving a sour pressure in its wake. What is this place? The light from the alcove comes in through cracks in the walls, so maybe not fully underground. Alright. Time to find out where you are. So you walk down the tunnel. You pass a dozen alcoves until around the corner you spy craggy, uneven stairs cut from the stone, leading up into brighter light. A courtyard. Better stonework here, giving off less cave energy and more Paleolithic civilization. The courtyard even has stone plates for flooring. Symbols carved into the faces of the plates have been worn down by the elements. You stumble on a loose stone tile, causing another coughing fit. The air no longer smells of stone dust, but the air all around you is still choked with dust. Red dust, like pollen. Does anybody read me? You're trying the radio again. This is Agent Kennedy requesting evac from wherever the fuck I am. On top of the complete blank on my location, I've got no food or water. Any help you can give me would be appreciated. Nothing. What did you expect? That there'd be better signal up above ground and out of the cave. Which is reasonable, but still not true, apparently. The muddy red dust motes float on the air like spores from a crushed mushroom. You can't help but breathe some of it in. It tastes like cinnamon and blood. The sour pressure in your stomach intensifies for a second. Please don't be sick. You don't need to vomit in this place. You cough again, this time producing red mucus into the palm of your hand. You're dizzy and exhausted. Alright, enough of this. You go back down the stairs and lay down on the stones in one of the alcoves. Over the next 12 hours, you rest fitfully, waking from nightmares, and then try to re-establish contact with command. You try on 4 separate occasions, each time walking up the stairs to the courtyard. In all that time, the light never dims, pressing into your eyes like a burning brand. Day 2. You know it's day 2 because of the augment in your eye. It's still counting the seconds for the mission timer at the corner of your vision. But otherwise, nothing has changed outside. You check every few hours. You had hoped something would make sense, that the sun would go down. Is it even the sun? Just suffused reddish light over reddish stones and scabby vines of teeth and viscera. The dust is worse now than when you first went topside, but you're going stir crazy. No radio contact with command for over 18 hours, and you need to find something to eat, and more importantly, something to drink. So here you stand, at the end of the courtyard again, staring out into the dust slash pollen slash bloodstorm. It blocks out anything more than a few hundred meters away. But unless you think this will end by wishing it, you know you need to get a sense of where you are. Working under the assumption that nothing I transmit is being received by command, but for posterity's sake, I'm leaving my shelter to locate food and water. If they can't hear you, how can they come find you? Would they even try? Can't be that concerned with your survival, or they would have sent you in with more firepower. How were 3 agents supposed to get out of that manor alive? You know the answer. You just don't like it. Your getting out was, at best, a secondary goal. Mission accomplished. They'll be remembered as heroes. Fuck all the way off. You tear at the hem of your evening gown and tie it over your face like a mask. You cross the courtyard and into the space beyond. It's a structure of similar materials, similarly covered in meat kudzu, crawling along the floor and up the walls. There's another stairwell here, going steeply up. You climb for nearly 5 minutes until you're on a bare rooftop overlooking the surrounding area. Through the swirling blood pollen, you can see nearly a dozen fat, black ziggurats in the distance. You stand on the top of what must have been a ritual space or temple complex, but it's seen better days. Huge portions of the roof have caved in, and whatever idolatry which used to decorate this place is gone now. You hold your high heels in one hand and your gun in the other. You take off the heels after only a few steps up the stairwell. As ridiculous as the dress is, the shoes are worse. Now that there's no cultist elite to impress and mingle with, you don't need them. They sail through the spores and into the blank red desert between your temple and another nearby. It's slightly easier to see long distances now that you're higher up, but the motes in the air are distracting. Not least because they coat the inside of your mouth and nose, even with the mask. Off in the distance, between the ziggurats, you can see long, black, organic-looking tendrils reaching for the sky. Sinewy fingers of thorny material shooting straight up and swaying in the wind. It's impossible to say what diameter they are, but their height is nauseating. Something that thin, reaching straight up and moving in the wind like reeds, it makes the back of your skull hurt. You decide to stop looking at them. The ziggurats shimmer in a heat haze that you don't feel. They refuse to solidify in your vision, like they're only partially rooted to the sand, and half of the buildings are built into another world entirely. The shifting spores make looking at anything in the distance hard, but this isn't that. This is your brain refusing to accept the ziggurats as being in the same space you are standing in. Looking at them directly is like staring down from an incredible height. The vision swims in front of you, their black stones vibrating just slightly out of sync with everything else. Much nearer, a building draws your attention. It is a windowless tower, nearly 4 stories in height, and topped with a dome. It leans heavily in your direction, which is what made you notice it. In fact, you can't figure out how it's still upright, with the lean so dramatic. It's got to be an almost 45-degree angle from the reddish sands. But there's holes broken into the side of the tower, and with that lean, you think maybe you could get inside. You climb down the stairs, cross the courtyard in a different direction, and walk out onto the sand in bare feet. It is lukewarm and spongy between your toes. Not like sand at all. You approach the leaning tower and look up to the nearest hole. Clearly something very heavy hit the stones and ruptured the structure. They make you think of catapults for some reason. You climb along the rough stones making the wall and tuck yourself into the opening, landing badly and rolling down into a room filled with urns. The interior walls are covered in the same organic material you saw in the chamber you woke in. The material is hardened, resembling the crust of a scab. In places, the material has cracked open with blood and bile leaking out. Amongst the pools of coagulated organic liquids, are hundreds of containers, earthenware, and wicker baskets. You start sifting through them, looking for unbroken containers. Most of them are empty or busted open, but you need to find something, so you keep looking. After an hour, you have found a total of 3 amphora that are sealed and still filled. One contains honey, the other 2 contain some sort of wine. As you crack open one of the wine containers, knowing full well you should be looking for water, you hear a deep voice coming from somewhere inside the room. It speaks no language you have ever heard before. "Hello? Say again?" The voice responds, but you still can't make out the words. The voice sounds like granite wrapped in velvet grinding together. It makes your head hurt. Listening to it is like trying to focus on those ziggurats. It's here and it isn't here. You're shaken. Here is a threat. Here is danger. You pick up one of the broken urns and brandish it as a weapon around the ruins of the storehouse. "I can't understand you. Who's there?" The voice does not repeat itself. Not for the first time, you wonder if this is some last gasp of a dying brain. If you're actually lying under tons of collapsed concrete and remnants of the manor as it fell on top of you. Is your brain bleeding as you mumble to yourself in a tumble-down ruin? Pragmatism wins you over in the end, thinking on the off chance you're not dead that you'd better act as if this place matters. You decide it's time to go, climbing down to the ground while struggling to keep the three amphora protected against your body. You slink your way back towards the original ruined temple. It's not comfortable, but it is the only familiar ground you know. The coughing hits you halfway across the short empty space between structures. You almost drop the amphora. You drink some more wine. It burns but has a pleasant aftertaste of nutmeg and cardamom. Maybe it's made from some rice, but you've never been a wine expert. It's just a relief to find something to drink. The climb and the coughing and the scare have wiped you out. You retreat back to your cool stone cave, prop yourself against a wall, and slide down to the floor. It takes a while for sleep to come, but when it does, another thought rips away the drowsy comfort of unconsciousness. If you're not dead, maybe that bitch from the manor isn't either. Maybe she's here too. And if not her, someone else. You slide your pistol out and lay it next to you, within reaching distance. This is not a place where you want to be vulnerable. Day 3. Far too much time passes without you doing much other than drinking the wine and sleeping. You haven't found anything to eat but honey, and nothing to drink but ancient wine. You can't just sit here forever. Nothing to be gained by drinking yourself stupid and waiting for something to eat you. You aren't a teenager sitting in the dark wondering about your place in the high school hierarchy. You're a fully fledged Foundation agent and in an alien world. You have a job to do, not least of which is finding a way out of this fucking place. So get off your ass. The spores slash dust storm have not lessened. And the light is still the equivalent of mid-morning. You try to transmit again. Everything I see is being recorded. If I get out of here, yeah, maybe. Maybe we can get something out of this. Kane never made it out of the basement. And Taylor, Jesus fucking Christ. You sigh and rub at your temples. You've had a dull headache behind your eyes for hours now. The ghost of a hangover, maybe. The target POI is apparently not here. Maybe I managed to neutralize her. Hit her right in the forehead before the room collapsed. Hope I killed the bitch. You start walking into the dust storm, holding one of the amphora in your hands. You should throw it away, really. More booze won't help anything. But you don't. You don't really care if it's bad form to be drunk on a mission. You don't really care if you're just making your dehydration worse. Wait, is that a myth? Does drinking wine make you more thirsty? Not that you're even feeling it yet. Too tired and sore and fucking terrified to feel thirsty. You adjust the impromptu dust mask of your dress material to fit snugger against your face. I don't know what to make of this place. The air tastes like blood, It burns. Look at what it's done to my skin. You hold out your left arm, showing the lesions running up and down your forearm to the recording augmentation. In the light, the lesions glisten slightly, like they're open to the air. It doesn't hurt, but does make the skin on your arm feel tight and uncomfortable with any flexing. Each of the small wounds is purple, and the surrounding flesh is tinted red with irritation. You wonder if leprosy is part of Sarkic magic. What do they call that? Something to do with meat. Of course it is. Always flesh this and flesh that. If you never had to read about another horror construct or eldritch cult, your life would be so much better. Is this a flesh-eating bacteria? You don't know how that works. You've always imagined your skin dissolving like a fizzy pellet you drop into water and drink to fight off nausea. What you wouldn't give for a fucking ibuprofen. The headache throbs behind your eyes for emphasis. I found some food, so maybe I can find some medical supplies as well. I know honey has some antibiotic properties, or I think it does. I smeared some of it on the lesions. No idea what I'm doing. I drank one urn full of wine. I guess it was wine. It tasted a bit coppery and reminiscent of cardamom, but also vaguely boozy. Sorry if that's unprofessional. I've been here at least 2 days, maybe more. But I'm not thirsty. I should be dehydrated, especially only drinking wine. You're interrupted by a screeching, echoing howl reverberating behind you. You turn quickly and look back towards the tower and ruined temple complex. Your augmented vision searches for contacts, a source of the unnatural sound. But you find nothing, and after a few moments to steady your breathing, you continue out into the dust. Bodiless voices talking to you in arcane languages. Shrieking beasts out in a dust storm impossible to locate. Stepped black pyramids that shiver in a heat haze despite the cool air, shimmering like a mirage even from up close. Flesh tendrils reaching up and up and up. And you're covered in little weeping wounds, making your arm look like it had been chewed on by 1,000 chittering insects in the night. When you were in training, they outlined what to do if you were in an extra-dimensional space, and none of that makes sense to you now. No one ever prepared you for the dreamlike quality of being faced with dozens of unreal but real things everywhere you look. Not for the first time, you wish someone would just tell you where the fuck you were. Is this hell? Is it a hallucination? If it is, you wish it would end. Day 5. Wandering past the ziggurats, while trying not to stare at them as they vibrate in and out of reality, and through the small forest of tendrils, which reach up at least 80 or 90 meters in the air, takes most of the day. You stop for rest in the shadow of a stepped pyramid, sleep poorly, and then continue on. When your chronometer says you've been here for at least 100 hours, you find yourself approaching a new structure. As you've been periodically doing, you try to transmit again. Keep some sort of record. It's not talking to yourself if you're making a record. I haven't seen anyone. Well, it's lifeless, but not. The ground is alive. The walls are alive. The place is crawling with flesh. The growth is everywhere, crawling up any surface that will hold its weight. And there's these spores in the air, so it's not as if this place is barren of life. But I haven't seen a single person or animal in all this time. No birdsong, no bugs, just spongy sand, blood-red dust, and scabrous kudzu everywhere. You're wandering along reddish sand, dotted with the occasional organic structure twisting in corkscrew shapes from the sand. You turn to the structure you just saw, a large building roughly 30 meters in height, which is made up of hundreds of strands of that same scabby growth. The strands burst from the sand without obvious foundation. Sphincter-like openings dot the side of the building facing you. You feel like the openings in the flesh are just like those that showed up in the manor at the end. Is that like a common aspect of Sarkic magic? Why couldn't you study something before a mission just once? I'm hearing things. Whispers in a language I don't understand. Fuck, I guess I have seen some people. And look at the growth. Tell me you can't see faces in there. As you approach the building, the vines twist into shape, mimicking a face contorted with agony. A pair of hands reach out towards you, frantically trying to find purchase. Then they're gone, almost as quickly as they appeared. You wonder for the thousandth time whether what you're seeing can be trusted. By the time I get any closer, they're gone. If someone is in that stuff, they want out. Or they want me in. Either way, a good reason not to get too close. The wind howls and you look up at the spore-dominated sky. And this dust or whatever, it moves unnaturally. Can you see it? It hurts just to look at it. Sort of floats on the air and moves differently than the wind. Maybe I've lost my shit. The voice returns, grinding dust between molars of stone and making sounds you've never associated with language before. You sigh. It isn't upsetting anymore. Or better to say, it isn't as upsetting anymore. Spooky voices lose a lot of the fear quotient when they just say random shit for days on end and never really get around to threatening you. If this was a scary movie, they'd have said something full of dark portent by now. But so far, it's just gibberish. I wonder if you're picking that up, or it's just in my head. The voice responds. More nonsense. It has to be talking to you. There's no one else here. Then again, you still can't figure out where it's coming from. What if it's not talking to you at all? What if the only active thing you've discovered here doesn't acknowledge your existence at all? You never realized how social a person you were. Nearly a week without interacting with a single person in a meaningful way. You would give anything to have an actual conversation. I wouldn't even mind hallucinating the voice if I could fucking understand it. A wind picks up, and the spores gather around your face, clouding your vision. You wave your hands in front of your face as if the spores were a crowd of bees circling, but the spores don't even notice your attempts to bat them away. They float around your arms and force their way into your ears, nose, eyes, and throat. You gasp, you choke. You cough wetly for several minutes. The fit winds you and you bend over spitting red mucus into the sand. You try to catch your breath and only stand erect when the coughing has subsided. A voice then says, "There. Much better." What in the? I understood that. The voice replies, "Good." Who are you? No. Fuck that. Where are you? What did you just do to me? The only response is the shifting sand and the sound of the wind. You scream. You scream until your throat is ruddy with blood and spores, cinnamon and copper in your mouth. You hyperventilate. You cough and cough and cough. You wipe your mouth with the back of your hand. And you see the lesions on your left arm have deepened to crimson. The lesions are less puckered, but the skin around them has a rough texture that wasn't there before. Your right arm is also slightly discolored now. Terrific. You move on from the building made up of corroded flesh and hair and teeth, and head out into the dust. What good is this mask even doing? Did the spores react to the voice? Are they doing this to you? Why? What have you ever done to deserve this? Fuck Command. Fuck the Foundation. And fuck all Sarkics who have ever lived. Day 7. What does time mean? The sun has set. You're sure of it. The red light has dimmed here. It must have at some point. The digital counter keeps going up in your vision. You wonder what would happen if you ripped it out of your head. Oh, look. Another run-down building made from red stones and covered in fleshy growths. If they didn't have such varied shapes and dimensions, you wouldn't be sure if you were looking at the same building day after day. Just walking in circles. Every landmark here you've seen is in one of several architectural styles, and you don't know what any of them mean. And still, you trudge forward. Wandering to this yet another dilapidated ruin, you find a room containing a primitive stove, a man-sized cauldron, and several earthenware containers. You find another jar of honey. Oh, thank fucking God. But the rest of the foodstuff is rotten, disintegrated, or consumed by the ropey tendrils of the organic growths crawling over every surface. You climb to the second floor, encountering a large room evidently designed for communal living. Against one of the walls in the living area, you see several wicker cabinets. You open them, finding a robe of material that feels like wool. You tear the ruined evening dress off your body and wrap the crimson robe around your skin. At the bottom of the cabinet, you find a belt made of some sort of leather with a simple clasp. You cinch the belt at your waist on top of the robe. You consider resting, but other than new clothes, you found nothing of use. Now you're wearing the clothes of someone 1,000 years dead. You should feel horrible about that, or at least uncomfortable. But the robes are still soft, and they only smell slightly of must. You're dressed like a bloody monk in some dark brotherhood, but hey, this place has offered so little comfort, why not take solace in what you can find? So you continue up the stairs. On the third floor, you find what must have been a library crammed to bursting, with shelves overladen with tomes and scrolls. At the end of the room, a table sits pushed up against one wall, and there's someone at that table, seated in a chair, holding an unfurled scroll. You approach slowly, with pistol raised. As you get closer, you realize the figure is wearing a full suit of ancient-looking bronze armor, posed as if reading. There's something strange about the armor. You aren't an expert, but every image you've seen of someone wearing bronze armor was limited to chest pieces and some guards on the forearms and legs. This is like a suit of plate. But was that even a thing during the Bronze Age? The visor is up, and you look into the cavernous space of the armor. The suit is sitting in the pose of a contemplative scholar, but there's no one home. The face mask is damaged, the metal flanging outwards like whatever ripped up the metal came from within the suit. Whatever happened, it was a violent escape. You imagine a tendrilled horror bursting from the face of some respectable knight, ripping through teeth and jaw and nasal cavity until pressing up against the bronze and tearing that like paper too. On the table is a bronze sword laid out in front of the armor, presumably belonging to the owner. You run your finger along the edge lightly, gasp, and pull your finger into your mouth. Damn it, still sharp. You pause as you consider the sword. Actually, you grasp the hilt of the blade, but notice a thin trail of organic material connecting the sword to the armor, and to a mass of that scabby kudzu on the floor climbing up the legs of the table. Your eyes trace a line from the armor to the pile of growth. Oh, fuck. You jerk your hand away, still holding the hilt of the sword, snapping the trail free from the larger mass. You hastily wipe down the hilt with the hem of your robes and back away from the armor. What the fuck happened to them? Was whatever burst out of the armor the person who used to wear it, and that's what is left of them in the corner? You look around at the walls of the building, at the hundreds of meters of ropey flesh tendrils that climb up every surface like the roots of a tree bursting up and over a retaining wall in a garden. Are these all people? Or worse, were they all grown from this one man and he just endlessly replicated his ligaments, teeth, blood, bile, and fleshy bits as they grew out of him? Maybe all these tendrils are the people who used to live here. Maybe they got what was coming to them. Maybe they shouldn't have been sarkic flesh-crafting maniacs. You feel hot and flushed, staring at them all. You need to get out of here. You rush down the stairs until you're free of the suddenly claustrophobic building. Your breathing is elevated. Your hands are sweaty. That was too much. If this was a hallucination, would there be so much you couldn't understand? There's no dream logic here, just stories from the long dead that you can't read. You slide the sword into the belt at your waist and walk out into the spores. Better to be out here than in there. Day 8. Is there any building still standing here? You crouch next to yet another ruined building, this one long and open like a small warehouse. This building is constructed of muddy red bricks, but still covered in that endless fleshy vine. The purple-black of the growth starkly contrasts with reddish bricks. The growth squirms as you lean in to see better. Through a window, a group of humanoid figures are gathered in a circle with their arms held high, surrounding a symbol that has been carved into the floor. They appear to be chanting, but their voices are muffled by distance and the wind. You concentrate, focusing past the constant distraction of the chest pain and headache brought on by the coughing. The augmentation in your eye enhances, showing the ritualists in greater detail. They are dressed in finely tailored, upper-class attire from a multitude of eras. There are tattered frock coats and half-crumpled top hats, whalebone corsets and dirty robe de style, rotten furs and three-button suit jackets with matching power ties. Nothing makes sense about it. But in this red nightmare, it's the least of your concern. Their faces, on the other hand, make you nauseous. The faces are chimeric, displaying octopus tentacles, bull's horns, eyes that look like insects, and other non-human features. None of the ritualists look the same as any other, combining a variety of non-human features. They are hard to look at. Gazing upon the symbol on the floor proves even harder. No matter how your eye focuses, you can't quite trace the lines of the sigil. You can see it all at once in a blurry manner or focus on individual parts, but you can't make it resolve in your mind. Every aspect of the ritual is wrong to you. Not morally wrong, exactly, although you do not hesitate to judge them and their disgusting religion, but off, out of sync with reality. If this even is reality. Their ritual continues for an hour, culminating in a fissure appearing in the earth in front of them. A bulbous cocoon of flesh emerges from the ground, around which the worshippers circle and touch their hands to its pulsating surface. Then their hands plunge into the pink, wet tissue with a sound like 50 plungers in 50 toilets being worked up and down. A large, vaguely human entity is pulled from the crevice and cocooned by the people. The new arrival is curled up in a fetal position on the floor and covered in blood and other fluids. The almost pitiable creature reminds you of a newborn baby, but muscular and covered in scales. The entity trembles for several minutes and then begins to rise to its full height, and nearly 3 meters tall. You duck down as their gaze passes your direction. Oh fuck. Oh fuck. You inch yourself up so your eyes barely clear the base of the window. The ritualists raise their arms in unison and call out a single nonsense word. A flash of light erupts from the center of their ring, and they disappear as starbursts leave you semi-blind. The augmentation starts acting strange, showing you several layered images of the room. You feel dizzy and smell burning rubber on the air, then fall and start seizing. You are completely aware for every second of the vibration, starting at the base of your skull and working down your spine, out along your limbs. It hurts more than you've ever felt. Worse than when you were shot that time. Worse than breaking your leg in junior high. The smell of your vomit is impossible to ignore. You've never had a seizure before. As you lie on your back, you feel your grip on the situation slide out of your consciousness. The eddies of spore in the air circle around you. You find yourself sinking into the sand, through blood and bones and dead insects, until you're floating in a murky darkness. A piercing red light shines on you. You have the sense of being watched from a great distance. You hear the song of the blood, the song that all flesh makes. The melody of growth and adaptation. The verses knit together like sinew, healing around bone and reattaching to muscle. Like individual cells of cancer searching for a home in your mother's breast. Like the life of a million insects growing, fucking, eating, dying, and repeating over millions of years. Then, just as suddenly, you are lying on the ground where you fell. The aura fading and leaving behind a throbbing pain throughout your body. As the pain pulses through your muscles, you slowly regain your wits. You still see double of the room, and you switch off the augmentation, causing the vision in that eye to dull. What the fuck just happened? You drink the rest of the wine. It seems that Agent Kennedy is not having a great time of it, experiencing the highs and lows of Sarkic hell, or perhaps Sarkic heaven. We already know that she doesn't make it out of there intact, but there's still quite a bit of her journey left. And maybe she'll manage to accomplish something while in there. We'll find out the rest in part 2.